The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we're going to be talking about investing in diamonds and how one company has seized the opportunity between technology and these precious stones to create the world's first diamond commodity. So our guest today, Cormac Kinney, the CEO and founder, joins us from New York City, the founder of Diamond Standard. Hello, Cormac. Welcome. How are you?
Hey, Mark. Very well. It's great to be with you.
It's good to be talking to you as well, Cormac. Looking forward to discussing what the company is up to. And of course, Kenny joining us from Scotland. So we have The Hague, we have New York City, and we have Scotland. So how are you, Kenny?
Yeah, all good. Great to have you on the podcast, Cormac. And it's it's a bit of a global podcast today, both sides of the pond covered. So no, it's great to have you on. And I had a bit of look at your bio and LinkedIn earlier on. So there's lots of questions to ask, but as I'm sure Mark's explained, what we like to do in this podcast is just get a bit about yourself, a bit about your background, you know, your sort of journey and sort of business and life, right up to the point where you founded the Diamond Standard. So really, we're kind of looking for a bit of a potted history of Cormac Kinney. If you could do it in perhaps 10 minutes, that would be brilliant.
Oh, 10 minutes, okay. Well, I don't usually talk about myself, but I'm happy to. So I grew up in the Midwest of the United States, kind of almost in the farmland. But I ended up going to university at Carnegie Mellon, and which is a really great computer science school. And I had a diverse opportunity with a lot of different classes. And I studied computer science, engineering, economics, and really bounced around. I ended up walking away with 3 degrees, including a master's. But I'm one of these people who is always exploring. My wife says I'm a curious monkey. I know a little bit about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And what that led me to be in life as an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And starting at university, I actually founded 3 software companies while I was a student at Carnegie Mellon. And incredibly, all 3 of them ended up being acquired by public companies. And they weren't huge. The last one actually was pretty big. The first 2 were pretty small, but they were some good new idea. One was involving projecting insurance premiums, and that was acquired by Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance. One was optimization of factory schedules, and it was a summer job at H.J. Heinz that turned into a software project that ended up being a company that ultimately was acquired by Oracle. So that was really pretty surprising to my professors. And because of that, I actually skipped my senior year at Carnegie Mellon and went straight to the graduate school. And in my second year at graduate school, they asked me to help develop a live trading floor at the university, which is called the FAST Lab, FASD. And suddenly here I am as a student. I've sold one software company and now I have access to all the technology you have on a trading floor. Real-time data feeds, state-of-the-art Unix-based computers, et cetera. And from that lab, I was very involved in developing this trading simulations that ended up getting licensed to all the other universities globally, including in Scotland. For Kenny. And but it's from there I developed this very simple idea called heat maps. And that word never existed. I actually coined that phrase. And people are surprised when I tell them I invented heat maps, because now you see them absolutely everywhere.
Yeah.
It's so stupid simple. And people are like, well, it's impossible that didn't exist. but it didn't. And I've had to actually patent battles and court cases, and I won them all. And I owned the word. I had the trademark. Wow. And that became the seed for a trading systems company that I started my last year of graduate school called NeoVision. And ultimately, with NeoVision, I designed over 100 trading systems for a lot of the largest buy and sell side companies, from Merrill Lynch and Bank of America and Goldman Sachs on the sell side to Payne Weber and a lot of other, Infidelity on the buy side. And I built parts of the NASDAQ, the NYSE, and the DTCC systems. They all involve heat maps, but more importantly, what I developed was one of the earliest real-time middleware platforms, and using in-memory databases was able to do analytics in real time. And this modular platform was used to build trading systems. And that's how we end up building so many, because you could basically just plug the pieces in. I ended up licensing that to, I don't know, about 400,000 traders. There were a lot more traders back in the 90s than there are today. And but I licensed it to Bloomberg, to Reuters, to Dow Jones, a lot of the SunGard, a lot of the platform companies. And that company, our investors, ended up being a lot of VCs, but also Bear Stearns, Deutsche Bank was our largest investor, and Intel was an investor. So it's from NeoVision that I really got a lot of firsthand experience with trading, trading systems, the information that's available to traders, and some of the challenges. That company ended up getting acquired by the Carlyle Group and emerged into SS&C, which is a conglomerate of hedge fund accounting and trading systems companies. That that experience, you know, because I built trading systems and I work with so many traders, you know, my personality is, well, I guess I can do that myself. Hmm. If they can do it, I can do it. And after I sold NeoVision, I ended up building my own trading system, which brought me back to Carnegie Mellon. And Carnegie Mellon is a center for computational linguistics. For example, if the Lycos search engine, which became Yahoo, started at Carnegie Mellon. And I took that technology, that machine translation, that text processing, and I built in 2006 what I think is probably one of the world's earliest sentiment engines. And what that means is I taught a computer to read the news. And the news that I was interested in is news about the stocks, mm-hmm. stock and stock market. So this system I built was able to take in all the real-time news feeds. Obviously, I'd spent the previous 10 years handling news data feeds. So I was very experienced in that. And I was very experienced in real-time analytics. So I used that experience to build the sentiment engine that would read the news in real time, extract which company is being discussed or which industry, and use that on a real-time basis to create a estimate of the positive or negative impact on the stock. And that system worked. And it worked at the right time. Because if you remember, 2007 and 2008 were terrible years in the stock market. There were a lot of short sale restrictions, a lot of extreme volatility, a lot of sell-offs. Yep. And a lot of quantitative traders lost incredible amounts of money, because everything became correlated when it came times for emergency liquidations. But because I was running a system with completely new and unused signals, I ended up having no drawdowns during 2007 and 2008. And by then I was running the quantitative strategies for Paul Tudor Jones at Tudor Investment Corp. So I was running a relatively small book as far as these things go, but I was running it at the right time. And as a result of that, in 2008, I ended up bringing that platform, this which was called Sentiment Strategies, I brought it to Millennium, which now is a $60 billion fund, and they're a real specialist in quantitative trading. And at Millennium, I ran a $500 million quantitative fund. And so that, inevitably what happens is that people realize what you're doing, the technology became more accessible, and a lot more people started trading on sentiment. And so I ended up merging that platform, that trading system into Millennium, and I moved on. And I started another company after that, which was not trading. It's the one that's not fintech, but I built a news recommendation system that ended up integrating with the Wall Street Journal. It was a joint venture with the Wall Street Journal, and that got acquired by News Corp. But that's what led me to Diamond Standard. That's when I was able to start Diamond Standard. Going back 20 years before, though, during this whole time, in 1998, I met my wife, Mimi So, and she's a famous jewelry designer here in New York. And so for the last, 17 years before Diamond Standard, I was learning about diamonds from my wife, being involved in her business. She's a jewelry designer and a diamond dealer. And I learned all about the challenges of diamonds. First of all, it's a huge industry. It's a $1.2 trillion market. And the problem with diamonds is that every diamond is different. There's no price discovery. There's no transparency. But in summary, what I realized was that there was an opportunity to create a diamond commodity using all the skills that I'd developed over the last 20 years as an entrepreneur, namely automated market making, statistical arbitrage, optimization, and the latest technology to that set is the blockchain.
Mm, yeah.
And those end up being the four pillars that make the diamond commodity possible. So let me pause there.
Yeah. That's a fascinating history. A lifetime of starting companies and entrepreneurship, it seems. What a track record there. I'm quite interested just to explore for a couple of minutes just the kind of entrepreneurial mindset, Cormac. How do you think you're just born with it, the kind of ability to think of ideas, but also to motivate yourself to actually execute these ideas? And how do you deal with sort of doubt and that kind of thing? You started a number of companies there. You must have had plenty of ups and downs along the way.
Oh, yeah. Payroll is always an issue. And, what's fortunately, I started very young. Mm. I was in university and I had a lot of help. At the school, I was able to borrow school equipment and lab resources and talk to professors. And quite honestly, I had nothing to lose.
Mm.
I had no mouths to feed. So I wasn't taking this life risk that if I devote all my time and attention to something with a potentially no payoff, I could afford to do that because very early in my career. And obviously I made a lot of mistakes and hit a lot of walls. And in part, I guess the easiest way to say it is I'm hard-headed. And maybe I'm willing to ignore all of the obvious challenges. And, later in life, you might realize that's almost impossible, or you can't do that because of this reason, whatever it may be. When you're young, you're dumb enough not to realize, or you're dumb enough to ignore. those challenges. And I, you know, it's not all been successes. I've had some failures, but you learn. And from everything I've learned, very often when the door slams in your face, you, if you start looking for a window, you can very often find a way in. And so it's that, you know, lack combined, you know, being a little bit dumb and just being relentless. That's for me, that's been the way I've made it through.
Okay.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say, Cormac, because it's taken me to my mid 40s before I finally, you know, I've always had that kind of business mindset, but I never had the opportunity. And I had to take a risk in my mid 40s of leaving a decent, well paid job. I had three kids, you know, and a wife, obviously, to support as well. And she was scratching her head, you know, why are you walking away from this job to take this massive risk? And I was of the mindset, well, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it, and I'll always wonder. So fortunately, it has worked out very well for me. But it was not by luck or anything like that. It was just sheer hard work and a bit like yourself, you know, just hard-minded and just getting on with it. So it's, and there's been lots of ups and downs as well. You know, you need a good kick in the backside sometimes just to refocus your brain and go again. And Mark will know what I'm talking about. We've had plenty of ups and downs along the way, haven't we, Mark?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. One thing that jumped out as well in your sort of bio there, Cormac, was the sort of new sentiment. And I think that's quite relevant today, obviously, with blockchain and crypto, because you've got this sort of fear and greed index. I mean, I wonder how that is that structured in the same sort of way that your software was designed originally?
A little bit. I mean, fear and greed really considers price.
Yeah.
And for our case, price didn't matter. All we are looking at is delta. So whatever the price is, we don't care. Is the sentiment moving up or down? And it's all statistical, because my portfolio running sentiment, on average, we had 700 positions at a time. And it's the big picture that matters.
Yeah.
Because those 700 pictures are positions are engineered to be risk neutral. So I don't buy an airline stock unless the computer also finds one to sell. And so that's what also happens with the diamonds. What we figured out was how to take a step back and look at diamonds from a statistical aggregate perspective. And that was the breakthrough that enabled us to make this commodity. And so that was kind of a common thread.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Sorry, Mark, on you go.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I think that it's incredible to me that you, you're able to, yeah, it's creative, but it's also the entrepreneurial mind that you can find links between two things. And obviously you have a history in developing systems, and it was in the financial markets. And then with your wife in diamonds, you sort of brought the two things together. And I mean, in the planning for a podcast that I did where we discussed diamonds with a diamond analyst called Paul Zimnisky, I was researching different things, different topics to talk about, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be cool if you could invest in diamonds like you, and you can invest in gold and silver, which I do. I know Kenny does. Kenny has he's a bit of a magpie when it comes to silver. I know he had a target he was going to. I'm not sure how close he is to that, but I just thought, wouldn't it be really cool to be able to do that? And then I discovered Diamond Standard. So yeah, you saw that, well, 7 years ago, and have managed to get to where you are. So I wonder, maybe if you focus on the current now, and tell us a bit about the big idea, if you like, of Diamond Standard. What was the big idea, and how did that develop?
Well, it you know, these things, it's strange how they come together. It took a long time. It was not like a light bulb went off. And what happened was, first I was approached by some commodities traders from Chicago, and really the whole industry. You know, now I meet with people from BlackRock and PIMCO and the CME, and they all say the same thing, is we've been trying to, you know, get to diamonds as an asset for 30 years, and we could just never figure it out. And I was approached by one of these groups from the CME, about 5 or 6 years ago, and they had an idea for basically creating an index. And the index, it was like a recipe. You know, you have a recipe with 20 different specific diamond types, like a 1 carat D flawless would be one diamond. And they had 50 more. And if they measured the price of these every day, they could make an index. And they asked me, given my experience, could I help them design a diamond exchange? And I looked at their ideas, and they even had a patent. And I realized this could never work, because all you would do is create demand for those 20 diamonds, or even if it's 100 or 1,000 diamonds, it doesn't matter, because there's literally millions of varieties of diamonds. So that's what really triggered my interest to look at it in depth and try to find a solution. And my background had been looking at regressions and scatter plots and statistical arbitrage. And I had a picture in my mind of a scatter plot. And when you run a regression on a scatter plot, it'll create a curve. And that curve shows you, you know, and you can measure the chi-squared, the distance of every item in that scatter plot away from that curve. And the curve is kind of a formula that would estimate the price. And everybody knows with diamonds, one thing that always holds true, that, you know, a diamond's value is based on primarily its carat weight, its color, and its clarity. And when the carat weight gets larger, or when the color gets more colorless, like decolor, or when the clarity gets more flawless, the prices go up exponentially. It's a variety of curves. Those curves are kind of indeterminate because they're subjective. And when someone makes a trade in a diamond, it's private. So no one's ever known these curves. And what I realize is, you know, those curves, they change over time. You know, as people prefer carat weight versus clarity, for example. But the light bulb that did go off in my head was visualizing a scatter plot. And instead of the data being random, if we had a curve that was a standard, for example, could we reverse engineer a scatter plot to match that curve? And that visual idea, which is kind of like what Einstein did, I'm not saying I'm a genius, but Einstein visualized relativity when he imagined the hands of a clock moving at the speed of light. And so that visual idea became the foundation for Diamond Standard, which is using automated market making to discover those curves initially, and then using that in the future to reverse engineer a scatter plot to create a consistent commodity. And I'll explain that in a minute, but sorry. That was the genesis.
Did you ever create that index then?
Yes. So it took many years and many patents later. Hmm. So if you'd like, I can kind of walk you through the concept, how we create the commodity. And it's interesting, and it's those four pillars of computer science. So in this chart is an overview of the process, and this is the best way I have to explain it. But I'm sure you've seen in the coin, diamond standard coin, and in the bar, there are diamonds. And the range of diamonds that can be contained inside a coin or a bar are actually 94% of all the different varieties of diamonds that you find out in the market. That range includes everything from 0.18 of a carat up to 2.05 carats. It includes all the colors, from D color down to L color. And it includes all the clarities of diamonds from flawless down to I1, some of the larger diamonds. So that range I've just mentioned, about 94% of all the diamonds in the world are in that range. It does not include pink diamonds, blue diamonds, Harry Winston 5-carat diamonds. It doesn't include microscopic or industrial diamonds. But the first foundation is that the diamond standard commodities can use almost every variety of diamond. And what that means is we are the first company that is a natural market maker. Because we can use 94% of all diamonds, we can make an actionable bid for all of those different varieties of diamonds. And as a market maker, we were able to form what's never existed in this industry, which is a actual electronic exchange. Mm-hmm. In the diamond industry, there's lots of things that they call exchanges, but it's very much like calling eBay an exchange. It's really where, you know, people just offer things and they might start a negotiation and then there's a private trade. Mm-hmm. What we created is an actual centralized limit order book where we, as market maker, create a actionable bid at all times for everything. And we invited the industry to join. So far, we have 150 members of this exchange and about 10 billion of supply available. Today, we have on an average basis at any given day, 500,000 to 600,000 diamonds are listed on this exchange. And I'm going to zoom in on a couple of these charts. But as I mentioned with the market making, we make an actionable bid on 16 million varieties of diamonds on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Every combination of carat weight, color, or clarity, I have a cash bid. And we actually don't have an algorithm. We don't have any expectation of what these diamonds should trade at. Like any other market maker, we bid low. And when we make these low bids, 99% of the counterparties say that bid's too low, but 1% say yes. For the bids that are filled, those become limit orders where we cancel any bids that are for nearly identical diamonds. So say, for example, the first bid is a 0.35 E VVS diamond. Once we have that diamond, we no longer need a 0.35, and we also don't need a 0.34 or a 0.36 carat diamond. And for everything that's left, we raise our bids. And that's the automated market making. And we've accomplished that on a much larger scale than any exchange in history with millions of bids. So that was a big breakthrough. But that automated market making process, what it results in at the end of the day is we buy a statistical sample of every combination of carat weight, color, and clarity. We force the market to tell us what are each of those diamond types worth. And we buy the cheapest, but we buy enough of everything to prove that we bought a valid sample. And that's the reverse scatter plot that I was referring to. We use automated market making to create that scatter plot and force ourselves to match the curves. You asked me, did we ever set a standard? Yes. So the first time we ran this process, we didn't know these curves. And instead, and this was entirely regulated, we're regulated by the Bermuda Monetary Authority and we're audited by Deloitte. But under their supervision, instead of having a target for the number of diamonds, it was really elegant and simple. We divided all of the qualities of diamonds into a few thousand buckets. One bucket, for example, might be decolor flawless between 0.25 and 0.29. Mm-hmm. That's one bucket. And in each bucket, we spent the same amount of money. And that money was the proceeds from our initial public offering. We had a $25 million initial public offering. So we spent the same amount of money in every bucket along all of those curves. And so the market then told us, for the same amount of money, how much color do you get on that part of the curve? How much clarity? How much carat weight? So we established a standard on that one. It took about a month to do all this buying because it was tens of thousands of diamonds. But we discovered for that month the yield curve of the earth, which is basically on a market value basis, how much carat weight, color, and clarity do you get per dollar spent? And that's the market telling us what that geological content is worth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a bit like the gold standard or the spot price of gold, how that is priced per ounce of 0.999 gold. With diamonds, it's more complicated, is it? The clarity, the color, and the carat. And in your token, you're accounting for 94% of the varieties.
Yes. So everything we do requires the law of large numbers, mm-hmm. which means we can't make a coin unless we buy 10,000 diamonds, mm-hmm. right? Because we need to prove that when we buy diamonds, we always buy a statistically valid sample. Mm-hmm. And that's where the blockchain comes in, okay. by the way. Because the first thing we do is we publish all the data and make it public so that we can prove and anybody can verify all the diamonds we bought. And did they comprise a statistically valid sample? Did we buy them through this regulated, transparent exchange, et cetera? And more importantly, the last step of this is that we developed another breakthrough in optimization, which is dividing those 10,000 diamonds fairly into the coins and bars. Mm-hmm. That itself is a statistical process and a sample. So every coin, even though it's only 8 or 9 diamonds, so you can't be a super high level of confidence, but every coin itself is a statistical sample of the entire 94% of diamonds. Mm-hmm. Every coin contains a progression along those curves of carat weight, color, and clarity. And they're very, very, very similar, but they're never identical. Yeah. But they all contain at least this minimal amount. So mm-hmm. every coin, if you look it up, it'll say it's 100% of the standard or it's 100.2, but every coin contains at least this minimal amount of geological content.
Yep. And I guess, Cormac, that obviously 2 or 3 times a year you will do a mint of so many coins. Is that how the kind of model works?
No, every week.
Every week? All right.
So every week we get orders for diamond standard coins. So this is very important. We never, ever set the price of the diamond standard coin, which is very much like a gold mine. The gold mine does not decide the price of gold. Barrick Gold's job is to make a kilo bar that is 0.999 pure and has 1,000 grams. Our job is the exact same. We have to make a coin or a bar that contain a public and identical geological content. And then the market tells us the price.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, it's quite interesting because obviously Mark had alluded to earlier on that I'm a bit of a silver magpie and it's quite bizarre. So just randomly, I've got a 5 kilogram bar sitting right beside me just now and it's probably worth the same as a $6,000 diamond standard coin that you're advertising on your website just now. So as an investor, you know, sell it to me, Cormac. You know, why should I swap my 5 kilogram silver bar for one of the diamond standard coins? I'm putting you in the spot, but it's quite interesting.
So there's a lot of magpies that like silver and a lot of gold bugs that like gold. And right now, hard assets are a key asset to have in the face of inflation and the monetary policies impact on the value of stocks, which are at all-time highs by no matter what measure you want to use.
Yeah.
So hard assets, just as a starting point, are an important investment. They're diversification. It's on your desk. It's not a stock that's a liability from somebody else. So your silver cannot go to zero. So diamonds are in that category now. Historically, diamonds were never tradable because there was no liquidity. There was no fungible unit that you could trade.
Yeah.
And as a result, the BlackRocks and the PIMCOs of the world, they don't own a single diamond because they can't mark to market their position until now. So if you look at all the precious metals, you'll notice something that's very consistent. Investors hold at least 15% of every precious metal, even palladium and rhodium, which aren't on this, rhodium's not on this chart. But investors of the world own 15% of the above ground rhodium. Silver is held by 19% of the silver is held by investors. But investors only own about 1% of diamonds. So the investment thesis is simply that now that we've created a fungible, regulator-approved diamond commodity, and as you'll see, we're also launching ETFs, futures, options, and other securities, we think that that makes diamonds accessible to investors and that they inevitably will buy up 15%. Because diamonds are a hard asset. They're totally uncorrelated, at least for now. They're uncorrelated to other assets. And all of our early investors understand this investment thesis, that as the BlackRocks, PIMCOs, JP Morgans of the world allocate to diamond, the value has to go up because of that demand.
Yep. I assume you can physically hold these diamond standard coins if you wish, or they can be stored in a vault similar to like Goldcorp or something like that.
Yes. So about 99% of our clients prefer us to custody in their name, and we have a global custody partnership with Brinks. Mm-hmm. So we store the commodity at Brinks. However, because it's a physical commodity, and it's new, we deliver the coin to anybody who wants it. If you take delivery, depending on your state, you have to pay sales tax.
Yep.
New York, that's 8.875%. So it's very unattractive. So we've arranged custody in Delaware where there's no sales tax. So the vast majority, 99% of our clients hold their coins and bars at Brinks, but because the diamond coins are so small, the custody fees are extremely low. It's 20 some bucks a year to custody a $6,000 physical asset. And because you have it at the custodian, you're able to trade it instantly, which we'll talk about in a minute. That's where the blockchain comes back in.
Yeah. I'm just thinking ahead here. So as more and more people, look to, to either physically own it or just, you just say, store it in the vault, there must be a squeeze in the diamond market then, because you're taking diamonds out of the market that were maybe earmarked for, industrial use or indeed jewelry, et cetera. Yeah.
So we're creating completely new demand. So I'll show you a couple of charts, which are a little bit interesting, that shows how things have changed. So if you look at diamonds over 17 years. And I chose 17 years because that's when the gold ETF was first launched. In the last 17 years, gold has gone up 4.5 times its original value. There was a peak in 2011, if you might recall.
Yep.
Then it kind of faded back and recently came back. And now for the last year, it's gold has not performed well. But anyway, over 17 years, gold, silver, and the S&P 500 have all appreciated between 4 and 5x over 17 years. Diamonds, however, were absolutely flat. And in fact, from 2011 through the end of 2020, diamonds actually went down 50%, very steadily. In late 2020, we had a front page article in the Wall Street Journal announcing that we had received regulatory approval to launch the first diamond commodity. From that day until today, diamonds have started an annualized 35% return. And diamonds, many times during the last year, actually outperformed the S&P 500, even though the S&P went up a tremendous amount this year. During that same period, gold went down 12 or 14%. So that broke the historical correlation between diamonds and gold, which had historically been somewhat correlated, and diamonds became equivalent to a overpriced stock over the last year in return. So we think that this is evidence so far of the impact of this commodity on the market. And recently, starting in December, diamonds have really jumped up, and that's coincided with our buying accelerating as well.
Yeah, because if you're doing a weekly mint, if you want to call it that, is it 10,000 you said you had to buy?
Or more. So yeah. We buy as many diamonds as our customers demand for coins. Mm-hmm. So when we buy the diamonds, we become very much like an agency trader. And we never buy for our own account. We don't own a single diamond. In fact, we never touch the diamonds. They're always handled by Gem Labs. And we just direct their buying and settlement. We provide global settlement via our exchange.
And you're seeing big demand from your customers.
Huge, yeah.
And are these mostly institutions, you say, rather than individuals?
No, they're right now. So this chart shows our progression of securities that we're launching in our rough timeline. So far, we've only launched the physical commodity, and in fact, only the coin. We're about to launch a bar, which is 10 times the value of the coin. And the bar is the entirely same process. It's just all larger diamonds. All the diamonds in the bar are 0.76 to 2.05 carats. That's the distinction. But it's mathematically engineered so that every bar, at least as of the IPO, is 10 times the market price of the coin. Mm-hmm. So right now the coin is today, I think, 6,100, and the bar will be 61,000 on that basis. So what we've launched so far was the spot commodity. For launching that, we had regulatory approval for a very limited offering for 25 million. Since then, we first got a $500 million approval. And now we have an unlimited approval from the regulator to sell coins and bars. And also, since the IPO of the coin, we got regulatory approval via the CFTC licensees, and we are launching futures on the CME Globex via what's an exchange called the MJEX. And we're also launching options on the MIAX Options Exchange. Those should both launch in Q2 of this year, roughly. But in the meantime, the first thing we're launching, which is launching in February, is the Diamond Standard Fund. And that fund is a vehicle that essentially turns the commodity into a stock. And if you're most investors really don't own, other than Kenny, most investors don't own silver bars. The vast majority of investors hold an ETF or maybe a futures contract. So these products will bring in the institutional investors. Right now, it's mostly private individuals and hedge funds that own the initial offerings.
Yep. And I'm just trying to get my head around this, Cormac. So where does your token fit into this? So say I want to buy one of these diamond standard coins. It's $6,100. I see from your website you can buy it either in US dollars or with the BCC token. Can you run over that process, please?
You can buy it for dollars, Bitcoin, or ETH, but you receive a BCC token.
Right, with you now.
So here's where it gets interesting. Inside each coin, there's a wireless computer chip. And that chip does a lot of interesting things. Number one, it provides auditing. So while these coins are sitting at Brinks, an owner like a BlackRock, who may own this commodity in a fund and they need to audit it, they can audit the commodity remotely over the internet. But that chip also provides authentication. And so if Kenny wants it in his pocket and he wants to sell it to somebody, that buyer can take out their phone and they can authenticate the coin using their phone. Their phone, using NFC, challenges that chip and then does an optical authentication. Every coin has an optical pattern, which is unique. So by authenticating it, you can trade it face to face. But by far the most interesting feature of the chip is that it holds a blockchain token. That token is regulator approved. It's the world's only regulator licensed commodity token. And what that means is whoever owns that token owns the commodity. Now, it has to be sitting at an approved custodian. So the coins have to be sitting at Brinks for you to transact the token on an exchange, for example. But while those bars and coins are sitting at Brinks, you and I can trade that token instantly on any digital exchange. These tokens are an ERC-20 token. So they're compatible with any wallet. They're compatible with most exchanges. And by trading that token, you trade the ownership of the commodity. The token is the regulator-approved settlement.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll need to do a bit of more digging on your website. It's one of these podcasts that's quite dangerous because obviously I've bought a lot of silver in the past.
I'm going to ask, have you clicked that buy button yet, Kenny?
I have got some Ethereum, but that's my reserve pot, so it is for a rainy day. But no, it's certainly very interesting, and I'll need to dig a lot deeper. But it's dangerous as well, so I might need to step away from the laptop tonight for a wee while.
It's fascinating. I mean, I think what you're pioneering, this whole idea of a diamond standard. I mean, you're pioneers, I think, in this space. And I mean, I guess one day your vision would hopefully see spot prices for diamonds like we do gold, EFTs, the diamond standard, as you say, funds, just like we see for gold and silver.
Exactly. So, in fact, we're already almost there. We already have a listing on Bloomberg, for example, for the diamond commodity. And we have a globally recognized index provider that'll be publishing that price, very much like the LBMA spot price for gold. And again, we don't set that price, the market does. But what's enabled by this token is a huge breakthrough, which is because that regulator-approved token represents the ownership of the physical commodity. When we launch the futures, for example, the futures contract is settled by the delivery of 20 tokens. It's instant electronic and global settlement of a hard asset commodity via a token. Mm-hmm. That same token, the same day, could become part of an ETF. or it could be used to trade the spot. So the tokens are all in one unified network where all of the demand and all of the liquidity is tied together. And everyone, no matter what product they're trading, simply has to move a token in order to incorporate that asset into a fund or a trust or an ETF. And the last thing we're launching is a currency called Bitcarbon.
Okay. And what's that all about? Can you tell us?
So Bitcarbon is a major breakthrough in the world of cryptocurrencies. And I shouldn't say currency because it's not quite a currency. It's a digital asset. And that's what we have a license to issue, is a digital asset. And it's really a commodity. It's not a currency the way you think of dollars or Bitcoin, for example. And we don't create the Bitcarbon. Whoever owns a bar or whoever owns a coin, as long as it's sitting at one of our custodians, like a JP Morgan or an HSBC, they can take their BCC token and they can add it to a reserve. And it's very much like the Federal Reserve in the US used to be, where we had a stockpile of gold and a certain fixed ratio of currency issued from that gold. We've recreated that using diamonds. And the reserve owns, once you transfer the token, the reserve owns your coin. And so it gives you Bitcarbon in exchange, and the ratio of Bitcarbon never changes. So every coin always represents 10,000 Bitcarbon. Every bar always represents 100,000 Bitcarbon. And what's special about this, because the coin and bar have this hardware token, we're able to attach the hardware to any different blockchain. So when you cash in your coin for Bitcarbon, you can choose whether the Bitcarbon exists on Ethereum or Solana or Stellar or Cardano, any other and many other blockchains. And no matter what blockchain that Bitcarbon is on, it always has the same value. Mm-hmm. And anytime that you want, you can convert the other way. You might have 2,000 Bitcarbon on 5 different platforms. You can still cash them in, and Kenny can then get a coin to put on his desk. He can redeem the coin from Brinks. He could actually choose to redeem it in Hong Kong, Geneva, or Delaware, anywhere in the world. So what we've created is the first universal currency equivalent. And unlike Tether, for example, which is a way to have dollar value in a token, we think that the value of the token goes up over time. We think it's hedged against inflation, and it becomes useful, especially on all these platforms, because we charge no fees. When you use the Bitcarbon for a transaction, there's absolutely no fees other than the underlying gas.
Yeah, that was a point I was going to come to, Cormac, because obviously you mentioned Ethereum and earlier on, and obviously the gas fees are just horrific there just now. But right. I'm glad that you mentioned that all the other platforms that obviously are much more gas friendly and obviously carbon friendly as well, because obviously the footprint of an Ethereum transaction is horrendous at the moment. So it is.
So we let the users choose.
Yep.
So the users, we think, will choose platforms that have lower transaction costs. Hmm. But we don't make that choice for them.
Yep.
So Bitcarbon will be coming out later, I think later this year. And we think it'd be a major breakthrough. Hmm. What's special about it is it's really all the best features of gold and Bitcoin rolled into one real breakthrough token. Like gold, it's a natural resource that's really scarce. But there's also some elasticity of demand and supply. If the price goes up, more people will sell their diamonds into the market, more consumers, for example. But like gold, it's recoverable. It's physical. There's underlying value. It's not just a token. But like Bitcoin, it can be transacted instantly and globally. The authentication is built in. You know it's authentic because it's on a blockchain. And the thing that we look at as potentially replacing is actually Tether.
Okay.
Interesting. Yep. Mm.
Yeah.
I think I'll need to keep that beer on the fridge tonight, Mark, because it could be dangerous if I have too many and I come back onto this website. But no, I'm really intrigued at Cormac. I never even knew anything about the company until Mark started chatting to me about it the other day. It certainly opened my eyes, and I'm going to do a lot more digging tonight, but maybe not after some beers because it could be dangerous.
Could be dangerous. As Kenny said, it is fascinating what you're doing. I think it's awesome. Of course, you're not a listed company. Maybe that's something you would look in the future. Maybe, I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but certainly fascinating for our listeners, I think, to hear about this diamond standard and, of course, investing in diamonds. And just a final thought, I know you've already sort of gone through the pricing of diamonds, but you obviously have your ear to the ground on in the diamond market. And where do you feel it's going to go in the short term and into the long term as well?
Yeah, so there's no – the diamond market is very interesting. My expectation is 85% of all the diamonds that will ever exist on Earth have already been sold to consumers. Mm-hmm. They haven't discovered a new significant diamond mine in over 20 years since the Canadian mines. And they've closed several of the major mines, which I think Paul may have mentioned. So the diamond supply is diminishing. There's very, very small reserves. And our supply, we expect 85% will come from consumers. And it's hard to buy the diamonds from consumers. There's a lot of friction. We have to educate. There's logistics. And most consumers bought diamonds at retail. So what we expect will happen is that diamond prices will go up by multiples. I think so far it's been 35% annualized. I think that starts an exponential curve where diamond prices start going up rapidly as we launch the ETF, for example, as we launch the futures and the private funds. That demand, as you have institutional investors, pensions, and endowments buying diamonds, that's got to drive the price up. And I don't think we'll be able to extract the diamonds from consumers very, very quickly. So that'll take some time. Ultimately, at some point, diamonds will get added to all the commodity indices. They're not in the indices right now. Once that happens, you'll have the sovereign wealth funds that allocate 5% or in the Middle East, 10% of their assets to commodities. They will start automatically building positions that'll be very, very substantial. So each of those inflection points drives the demand at a higher angle up that exponential curve.
Fascinating. I'm quite excited. I feel that we're perhaps having this chat now at the start of something really exciting happening in the diamond commodity market, and really appreciate your time, Cormac, on the podcast today. Kenny, do you have any final questions?
Oh no, I'm just, like I say, I'm really, really intrigued, Cormac, so I'll be scouring the website tonight, and I'm sure Mark can give you, I can get your email from Mark, and I can, if I've got any questions, I'll drop you a line. But
yeah, no, and if you fancy lending me $6,000, Kenny, then
sell some of that ETH.
Yeah, well, it's really bizarre because this particular bar I talked about earlier on, so it actually has the authentication certificate actually inside the bar as well, but obviously that's physical. But obviously things have progressed a lot since this bar was made. I think it was made 10 years ago or something. So it's all good. And I appreciate the time, Cormac, and I think it would be great to get you back on maybe 3 or 4 months time when you're looking to launch the Bitcarbon.
Absolutely.
Yep, brilliant.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Cormac, for your time, the CEO and founder of Diamond Standard.
Thank you, gents.
Thanks.
Good with you.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.